I don't normally take offence to your bad jokes, as I know you are not given enough time to consider each answer. However, so many people thought your prostitute joke was funny last night. But I need to remind the audience of the truth that prostitutes are not frisky. They do not enjoy having sex. Never forget they are the victims of socially acceptable sexual assault. Yeah? Yes, okay. But it's only a joke about, you know, being frisky or whatever. And just, I was trying to get the point across that sometimes if that is some of your nature or training or conditioning, that actually is almost locked in the heart somewhere. So anyway, you see, I don't make up these questions. These are real questions. They're not always praising me. Could you please explain how the 10 fetters, and in more detail, to one of the morning talks? Do you want to know about the 10 fetters tomorrow morning? Okay, that's tomorrow morning's talk. The 10 fetters. It's unfortunate for those who have not yet gained an appreciation for the chance that I chance each day during this retreat, as at these times is a wonderful opportunity to reflect on the compassion and kindness of the Buddha, who has passed on to us a path that will lead us out of suffering into happiness. Our daily chanting also provides the opportunity for other beings to hear the qualities of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha in a way to loving kindness. It's interesting, some people hate the chants. Some people love the chants. Most people are in the middle there somewhere. So who's right and who's wrong? Like sometimes, you know, it's just like the food. Some people like this food, some people don't like that food. And in the end, I mean, you try to do the best for everybody. But, it was Roosevelt said, you can please all the yogis some of the time. You can please some of the yogis all the time. All the yogis some of the time. But you can't please all the yogis all the time. I said something, was it yogis? Was he teaching a meditation retreat? I don't know. But anyway, so it is optional, the chanting. So if you really like it, come. If you're stuck here and you don't like the chanting, put your fingers in the air. If you love it, then just get into it. That's one of the nice things about Buddhism. It's really nice and free and easy. We're not telling people, you know, what to do or what they want to chant or whatever. If you like it, come. If you don't have to. It's optional. It's the same as though breakfast is optional. You don't have to have breakfast. If you want, you can say, no, I'd rather do some chanting. Shows what you really like most of all, isn't it? That's what sometimes that, you know, you see people in these retreats, they can't make it up for the morning chanting or for the talks. They're always there for the breakfast. They're always there for the lunch. Always on time, so it's really interesting, isn't it? It says something. But anyway, some of the chants that personally, you know, these chants we do just now, the metta chant is very, very good. The other ones, it's, you know, just the qualities of the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. But the chants I really like are the suttas. You know, we do in the monastery during the range retreat, we do the Dhammacakka Sutta in Pali. And you know, you learn Pali as a monk. It just has such great meaning. And the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta and the Fire Sermon. These are great teachings. So when we chant them, I really get off on those because I'm listening to them, I'm chanting them. And it's just beautiful, beautiful teachings of the Buddha. And to me, the Pali is, if you try English translation, it's never good enough. Because the original Pali, you can't translate some of these terms. And they just have a meaning. Because I've been a monk all this life. I've grown up with these terms. These are the suttas I know. I just love them so much. So I really get off on the chanting. But other people, you haven't got a clue what we're chanting. It's all gobbledygook in Pali. So, you know, maybe you get off on the feeling of it. And sometimes that feeling is quite powerful. But other than that, I'm not quite sure if some people enjoy it, some people don't. So you can't please everybody. Just like me telling jokes sometimes. I mean, jokes are sometimes really offensive. I get into big trouble sometimes. You know, once in a newsletter, many, many years ago, I used to write an article in our first newsletter called Sangha News. And, you know, it was a jokey article saying what was happening in the monastery at that time, all the buildings. And I knew that people were very busy, and so they just flipped through those articles because they were boring. But, you know, when it came to my article, there was lots of jokes in there and funny stories in there. And that's why people loved that. But I got into trouble because sometimes the joke went too far. And I remember once I was talking about, we just finished the bridge, this concrete bridge. And at that time, we had this plan that on the other side of the creek in the monastery, that would be the nuns' area, the women's area. And the monks would be on the near area. And I just said, this, you know, whatever I built was always over the top, incredibly strong, built to last, you know, for the millennium. So it's this big concrete bridge with lots and lots of reinforcing. And so, and I just made a joke. I said, look, this is built strong enough for two fat nuns to go over. And oh my goodness, I really got hammered for that. People actually threatened to resign from the Buddhist Society. You can't say that nuns are fat. No, you're only trying to, you know, I've got the goodwill there, it's just a joke. You know, fat monks, I don't call myself a fat monk, but you know, fat nuns, it was just a joke, just how well it was constructed. And be truthful of it, and some nuns are fat. And that's just because they're happy. That's the trouble sometimes, that, you know, we tell jokes, sometimes it's always one person going to take it the wrong way and get offended, but never mind, anyway. Okay, Ajahn, because a lot of people prefer to meditate while leaning their backs against a chair or a wall, does this mean we are in the Dharma reclining age? Okay, actually somebody got that joke. Yeah, it's anyway. Yeah, I know, you've got to be, actually, you know, people still keep sending me science articles. And for all these years, you know, I was told you've got to sit up with a straight back and you get nice and strong and healthy. But the research, somebody sent me the paper, if you sit with a straight back too long like this, you actually get back problems. I'm very fortunate, I don't have back problems and knee problems. I'm very healthy in that area. But the best posture to sit for long periods of time is about 15 degrees from the vertical. Just like all of you are sitting on the chairs. It feels comfortable, doesn't it? You know, that's why the backrest of the chairs have actually developed that way. It's just evolution, the survival of the fittest chair. You know, the one which gets bought the most because it's most comfortable. And so there's a reason why those chairs are not vertical at the back, they're leaning slightly backwards. It is the most comfortable position for your back. So all the wise meditators, the advanced ones, they're all the ones sitting on the chairs. You know, all the stupid ones, you're sitting on the floor, and you think you're so much better. You know, just look at those gallywags, namby-pamby cream puffs, sitting up on the floor. They don't even enjoy anything. If you really want to get enlightened, you've got to sit cross-legged, full lotus, on broken glass, endure pain, and then you're the real meditator. Some people are like that, but no. So that's just leaning back actually is comfortable. It feels comfortable, doesn't it? There's a reason for that, because it is comfortable. That's why meditation, ask your body what it feels like. Don't look at the books. Don't do what, you know, the teacher says or what, you know, you think you're supposed to do. Feel the meditation. Feel the body. And then you know what's the best posture for you. And there may not be any other meditator in the whole universe since the time of seven Buddhas ago who meditates in the same posture as you do. It may be totally unique to you, but it works. So you figure out what's the best one for you. You feel it. And that's the best one for you. So leaning on the back, on the reclining age. Ajahn, do we have free will if there is no self? Of course you don't. Will cost you. It's not free. Every time you will something, it's going to cost you something. That's why I think I remember reading this story about free speech. Because the Labour government here in Australia heard about free speech and said, no, 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 that's not good, we should tax it. And it would be a very good idea to tax speech. So people who talk too much, they're the ones who'd have to pay all the money. And to keep everybody, it would pay off all the debts, would be able to run our schools and hospitals properly, because how much do people speak? Wouldn't it be wonderful to actually tax them if they spoke too much? because actually shut up a lot of people, especially irritated. Of course, monks will get exemptions because that's our job. But people who speak too much have to pay. And that would create a lot of peace and quiet in our communities. Imagine that you have this little meter next to your mouth and see how much you spoke. And at the end of the month, you have to pay if you spoke a lot. And you save a lot of money and you save a lot of divorces if you shut up and don't speak so much. And you'd be raising money for good causes. So if the government does that, I think our Buddhist society should do that. We should do it like a tax on speech in the Buddhist society. And that will raise a lot of funds and also keep people quiet. So no, there is no such thing as free will. Every time you do something, it costs you. That's why they say, this is deep Buddhism, will is karma. When you will, you create karma. And karma has consequences. It's not free. So be careful. Every time you will, every time you choose, every time you do something, you're creating karma. It's not a free ride, baby. You have to pay at the end of the journey. So make sure. If you are making karma, make sure you make good karma. But the best is no karma. That's the best of all. So, there is no free will. As I said, do you really think, whoever wrote this, do you really think you had any choice but write this? Okay, all these stories about free will. Advertising. Why do you have your hair that particular way? Did you really choose fashion? When I was a student. Of course, as a student, you know, you want to be attractive to the opposite sex. You're looking for girlfriends. And I saw on the TV, and I will never forget this. I've said this story quite a few times. The TV was advertising tobacco. And I remember it's called St. Bruno tobacco, and you put it in one of these pipes, you stick in your mouth and you light the end, and you smoke the pipe, St. Bruno tobacco. And in this advertisement, this ordinary looking guy, I mean he's really ordinary looking, he put this tobacco in his pipe and lit it, and the aroma was irresistible to girls, especially to beautiful hot girls. Because he lit this and he walked past this news agent just selling papers. And there was a girl behind the counter. Now, she really was beautiful, like some supermodel. And as soon as she smelt the aroma of St. Bruno tobacco, she was totally enchanted. She jumped over the counter and she followed this guy, willing to do his every command. And then he passed the greengrocer's shop selling vegetables and fruit. And there was another gorgeous redhead there. And she too was entranced by the smell of St. Bruno tobacco. And then she passed the bank and the bank teller, this gorgeous blonde. She too was totally enraptured and followed him. And there they were. Tell me what to do, master. Tell me what to do. And it said, St. Bruno tobacco, irresistible. There's a totally ridiculous advertisement. Sometimes you see them, they're a bit more smart these days, but that was in the 1960s. So guess who bought some Bruno tobacco? I admit it. And I tried it. I lit it and walked down the street. Not even a dog followed me, let alone a pretty girl. It didn't work. I was really fed up with it. But the thing is, I tried it. So have you done that sometimes? Right, this hairstyle, this will really catch the boys. Or this scent, irresistible, you see it. Or the car, you know, you get this car and in the advertisements there's always a girl sitting next to it, a beautiful girl, not an ordinary girl. And you buy the car, and no one sits in it, you're buying it. So why do they do that? They're stupid advertisements, aren't they? Do they affect you? Of course they do. You are the ordinary person, there's nothing special. The reason there's so much money to be made in advertising is because they affect each one of you without you realizing it. And you buy those products. So when you go into the shop, You think you have free will to buy whatever type of muesli you want. But you're not. You're already conditioned by the advert. But it appears to be free will. If it truly was free will, all the advertising agencies would go out of business. They have conditioned you. They have made you buy that. I understand that nature of will. That is why I've told quite a few of you, if you have a problem in your meditation, do exactly what they do in advertising. Suggest. Program mindfulness. If you're always wandering off into thoughts and fantasies and dreams, you tell yourself at the beginning of the meditation, I will not go into fantasies, I will not go into fantasies, I will not go into fantasies. You're having a marketing campaign. You just say it to yourself and say it to yourself, say it to yourself. You think, that can't work, that's not really, I'm not listening to that, that's not affecting me, but my goodness, it does. You're about to go into the fantasy and you remember, no, stop. It just comes up and it takes you in a different direction. You are conditioning your will. Self-brainwashing. And if you haven't brainwashed yourself, I have. I have been brainwashing you for the last, I don't know how many days. That's why you sit meditation and you go, make peace, be kind, be gentle. That didn't come from you, that's me. I've been brainwashing you for days with that. And that's what happens, that's what brainwashing is, that's conditioning. But it appears that you will it. So what you take to be your will has already been pre-programmed in there. It's not your will. If anybody's interested, go look at the work by Professor Libet, L-I-B-E-T. He did this wonderful experiment that, a very simple experiment. He just got people to close their fists and just to open it whenever they wanted at random. And he had this incredibly powerful technology that when the fists started to move, he could actually time it to the millisecond. At the same time, he had this gizmo on the people's brains because there's something called the readiness potential. You can actually see in the brain when you're about to move something, and he could time that again to the millisecond. And the other thing, in the left hand, they had a little button. So when the person decided to open their fist, they could press the button at exactly the same time. So you could actually see on the machines the hand opening. You could see when the readiness potential, when the brain gave the order to open, and the fellow could actually tell you when he decided. And of course there was adjustments, because you know when you decide it takes a little time for that decision to actually to go into your finger and press the button. But what they found very clearly, Professor Libet, L-I-B-E-T, was the readiness potential preceded the will. In other words, by the time you decide, the brain's already started the actions. What you see, experience as your will, is not the beginning of the action. The action has already started. That's one of the early parts of the process, but it's already started. Once you experience will, the process is already underway. He was proving that this will is a delusory experience. You experience it, but it's not what initiates the action. It's something which has already initiated something. It initiates that which you take to be will, and it initiates a process which comes afterwards. What initiates it is not the will. It's not you. So by the time you are mindful of wanting to do something or doing something, it's already past the point of no return. The will doesn't start things. Things have already started. And then you notice the will. So, that which you take to be will is an illusion. It's not free at all. You've got no choice. Ha ha ha. That's okay. This is a joke here someone's printed out. A Sunday school teacher asked the children just before she dismissed them to go to church, and why is it necessary to be quiet in church? And she replied, because people are sleeping. So that's why you should be quiet when you come into the meditation room. Dear Ajahn, please explain why you said we didn't come here but we were sent. I just said, I've explained that to you. You were sent by you, or sent by me, or sent by somebody. By the time you decided to come here, it was already done. He asked, why did you come here? There's lots of causes and conditions, but it wasn't your free will. So, that's a nice thing to know. This will, what actually is it? You can actually experience it, but it's not what initiates action. Something else does. Another one which is typed out. Thank you for the liberating teachings of kindness. Actually, I didn't do them. It's not my will. I had no choice but to teach. Thank you for the liberating teachings of kindness and no measure. It's wonderful if I don't measure myself. Also, it was so helpful looking at the positive in myself and others. Question. With a tadpole and lake, you can only know what water is if it disappears. Following that logic, would that mean we can only know what consciousness is if it disappears in Nirodha, that's the cessation of everything? Yes. However, in previous talks you said that a gradual disappearance of consciousness from bliss to suffering states is enough for the mind to infer consciousness is not self, since the view of self can be abandoned after second or third jhana without going through Nirodha. It would be wonderful if you could explicitly discuss again abandoning the view of self without everything disappearing. Okay, it's a technical question, but it's a good question. When I said, was it this morning? I'll lose track of time. About the simile, yeah, it was this morning. The simile of the tadpole in the lake. Only when the tadpole becomes a frog and jumps out of the lake can you know what water is, because that's what's disappeared. And I said, the only way you can know what the body is when the body disappears. The only way you know what will is when the will disappears. So what about consciousness? Now what actually happens is, once you get into the jhanas, then the next thing which disappears after will is your consciousness. Already five consciousnesses have disappeared. The seeing, the hearing, the smelling, the tasting and touching, that's all stopped. And now, the last of those consciousnesses, the knowing, is disappearing. And that's actually why it gets more and more subtle. This thing we think of as the mind has got many layers to it. And the layers are vanishing one by one by one. And you're seeing the consciousness is disappearing, is vanishing. And as you see it vanishing, it's like maybe you might say bubbles in the lake. It's not totally vanished, but it's vaporizing, getting less and less and less. And by that you can know that even this knowing can stop. It's not you who does the will. It's not you who is the one who knows, because you see this whole thing disappearing and vanishing. And of course that's an incredibly difficult thing to do, and for many of you think that's absolutely rubbish and ridiculous, just like many of you can't get your head around the idea that this will is not yours, that you're not in control. There's no such thing as free will. There's no such thing as the will being controlled by some God either. It's somewhere in between. Just a process. And to have this idea of this knowing, the thing which is listening to me right now, to have this idea that this isn't you, that this can actually stop, is the stuff of the insight which makes you enlightened. You can't think it. You can't sort of analyze it logically. It has to be an experience. Which is why you need these incredibly powerful states of meditation. It's what somebody said, and they said this to me, one of our members here, and he said, to get those sorts of insight, you need the biggest kick up your bum ever. That's what he said. He said, yeah, that's what the jhanas do. They make you see things in a totally different light, because it's an incredibly different experience. And that's actually how it happens. It's wonderful to know there's no one behind my eyes, that I'm not in charge. Anyway, next question. How can you explain the fact that a person like Devadatta, who had hatred and animosity towards the Buddha, supposed to have achieved jhanas? He had those jhanas and then he lost them. That was a problem. So this guy, he did experience the jhanas. He had, this was Devadatta, this was the Buddha's cousin, they were monks together. He did practice and get those jhanas, but as soon as he got those jhanas, he got some psychic powers too. He also got pride. Look how great I am. I got jhanas and you guys ain't. He didn't have enough knowledge and wisdom because he was so stubborn. He was always looking upon the Buddha as his rival, so he never really paid much attention to the teachings. So he had the match but not the gunpowder, so he didn't get enlightened. So he had the idea of a self. It's me who's got those jhanas. It's I have attained these things. And because of that, he got proud and he just wanted to take over the Sangha, to lead it. He got pride. Pride led to anger. And as soon as the pride came up, he lost all his ability to do the jhanas. They all disappeared. There's something very wonderful about these deep states of meditation. If you have, you know, bad mind states, you lose them all. You just can't do them anymore. So if you get angry, upset, or the worst thing, spiritual pride, then you lose them. Which is why the Buddha often said that if you do get into a jhana, the right person never thinks they're better than others. You know, in case you know you've got some nice meditation, you ask your friend afterwards, what did you do? And they said, oh, I just had a terrible retreat, you know, I could hardly sort of stay awake. You don't look down upon them. You don't say, oh, you're a hopeless meditator, I'm much better. You don't go around after the retreat and say, you know, what did you do in the retreat? And your friend said, I got first jhana. You say, first jhana, I got that the first day, I got second jhana, you're hopeless. That sort of one-upmanship, spiritual materialism, is just nothing to do with Buddhism. And in fact, you try that, you lose everything. So there was that Trungpa, he quoted this, he coined this word, spiritual materialism. Just like in the world, we're always trying to compete with each other, you know, who's got the biggest house, the best car, the new watch, the latest iPod or iPhone, whatever, the iPad or whatever is going. You know why people want to get it first? Because of just pride? Who's got the best teacher? And someone goes, oh, my teacher, Lama Zopa, is much better than your teacher, Ajahn Brahma. Oh, none of them are very good. Thich Nhat Hanh, he's the best teacher. And sometimes that sort of stuff is just spiritual materialism again. And when that happens, you lose everything to do with the spiritual path. This is letting go. This is not judging. This is being kind, embracing, respecting. Those are the qualities of, you know, the spiritual path. And Devadatta lost it. And when he lost it, that's when he not only lost his jhanas, he couldn't get into them anymore, but he also got angry and upset. So that's actually what happened with him. So these jhanas, they're built on just this wonderful sense of letting go, the purity of mind. If you lose that purity of mind, you've lost it. That's why monks like myself tell you, don't judge. Just because you've got a jhana, you come and see me and I say, very good. You say that you've been sleeping all the time, I say, very good. Because, you know, I'm not trying to judge you, but I'm trying to build you up. So just because you've got a jhana doesn't mean you're a big shot. If you've got the jhanas, I won't get you to sit in front. I won't get you give you a medal you can put on your chest, the first jhana medal, so you can proudly say, I've got first jhana, and you get two medals, second jhana. Look at me. And when you get enlightened, you get a funny hat to wear. So you don't do things like that. So that's actually one of the reasons why monks, you ask them, okay, Ajahn Brahma, we'll come up one of these questions. Are you enlightened? Come on, let us know. You know, all these jhanas you teach, have you really experienced them? Come on, let us know. We deserve to know. I'm not allowed, permitted to answer you. And the reason was the Buddha wanted to make sure that every monk and nun is treated equally. Otherwise, suppose you had in our monastery, he said, yeah, Ajahn Brahma, yeah, he's enlightened, and Ajahn Bhamali is enlightened, Ajahn Appi, no, he's nowhere. And straight away, if you thought like that, you'd treat everybody differently, wouldn't you? You know, you give respect to some and not to others. It's nature. So the Buddha made it quite clear, no, monks, don't tell anybody. Keep it quiet. And that way, everybody is treated equally, and there's no possibility, or very limited possibility, for spiritual pride in the monastic community. As there should be no possibility for spiritual pride here in this meditation retreat. So that way, we keep things quiet. If you get the spiritual pride, actually you lose the path. It's all about letting go, not attaining. Please explain a bit further about jhana 2. Okay, in the second jhana, okay, your body has disappeared. First jhana, that's the bliss of having no body. But the mind is still moving slightly. The reason why it's moving slightly in the first jhana, yes, you have let go, but there's almost like an echo of your will, a reverberation. It's experienced like the wobble. Yeah, you've got this incredible bliss, which you merge into this bliss, but then it leaves you and you go in it again. You don't go too far away. It's just so blissful, it brings you straight back in. But the reason it's not stable, because you're holding it. There's a slight bit of attachment, grasping left, but not enough to destroy the state. So because it grasps, you're not 100% letting go, it's 99.99 letting go, but there's still a slight bit left. That is what keeps it unstable, and you move back again. You move out and then you go in again because it's just too powerful. That wobble. Eventually you have what they call the confidence to let go 100%. That last bit of doing disappears because of you're totally confident you can let go. That confidence, ajatang sampasadanang, that confidence means you have no fear. You can totally let go. Many of you, you can let go so much, but you keep a little bit back, a little bit of control, just in case. That stops you. You have to totally abandon, let go. Trust it's going to be okay. The body disappears, you're okay. You have to let go, just like the sibling of the baby in the mother's arms in the shopping mall. Because I've seen that sometimes in a busy shopping mall. It's a little baby in the mother's... Actually, the mother's arms, you've got the baby in one arm, shopping bag in the other arm, and this baby is fast asleep. And I just can't understand, how can a baby be fast asleep? This is really dangerous, just one nudge, one bump, and the baby will fall on the floor. But the baby is just so confident in its mother, it's totally fearless of falling, and so it goes fast asleep in a busy shopping mall. Because 100% confident it can let go. Exactly what happens in the meditation. You're 100% confident, you totally let go. And with that total letting go, that's ajatang sampasadanang, the inner confidence. That means the will stops. You don't have to do anything. And it stops dead. And that's what the second jhana is like. Absolutely still, rock solid, like a diamond, and nothing moves, and you can't move. It's impossible to move. The will has disappeared. And it's another degree of happiness. It's like you've been, sort of, you had a boss at work. And the boss is always looking over your shoulder, telling you what to do. Do it faster. Don't do it this way. Do it that way. Continuously, all day. And that's a pain in the back, or the neck, whatever. And that boss is called will. And then the boss disappears, and you're free. You're not being told what to do by anybody. Which means you're still at last. You don't have to move. Peace at last. And that second jhana, you feel the bliss of not needing to move. Absolutely still. It's a different type of pleasure, but much, much better than the pleasure which was in first jhana. They call that the peak of samadhi, the peak of stillness. Nothing's moving anymore. And that's beautiful. Now, some of you say, well, I've been still. No, you have not. I'm not willing anything. I've let go, but the potential is there. You just chose not to. It's a choice. Here there's no choice at all. You can't do anything. So in those states, you just can't get out. That's why you stay there for a long period of time. There's just nothing to take you out. The will has stopped. So how can you get out? And it's just after a while, the will starts again by itself. You don't do it. It's just the karma, the momentum is over, and then you just start. And with that first movement of the mind, you're out of the jhana. Which is why that sometimes a litmus test to find out if you are in a jhana, if you ask the question, this is jhana or is this a jhana, then you know for sure it can't be. If you can ask that question, it's not the jhanas. It's impossible to ask such questions. The mind just cannot move. That's why, if you ask a question, I'm sorry, it can't be. So, that's some more about the second jhana. Does that make any sense? Probably not. But anyway, you asked, so there we are. Okay, here we go. A nice funny question. Do you know any insurance companies to help us ensure that we will be reborn in the Buddhist countries? We'll get excellent advice from the brilliant monk like me in case we can't get enlightened in this life. So insurance companies to ensure you'll be reborn in Buddhist countries. Okay. You've got the RAC, it's a great insurance company. The Reincarnation Assurance Company. I don't know, you can name it whatever you like. No, the best way to ensure you'll be reborn in a Buddhist country is because you hang around with Buddhists in this life, and then you actually be reincarnated in Buddhist life. So what the Buddha said, it's like a tree which is leaning to the east. It's likely to fall to the east when it dies. A tree which leans to the west when it dies is going to fall to the west, mostly. There's always exceptions, but mostly it does. So if you lean towards the casino, then when you die, you'll be reborn in the realm of the hungry ghosts. But if you lean, always going to the temple, always meditating, always being kind and generous, that's where you've been leaning, of course that's where you'll fall. So you can't fake it. The way you live your life is the way you'll die and the way you'll get reborn. That's why when someone asked me years ago, how can you ensure a good death? By living a good life. There's no shortcuts, unfortunately. Oh, how many of you know the story of the businessman with the three sons? Do you want to hear that one again? You all asleep? Okay, once upon a time. There was a businessman living in Perth. I always change it to where I'm giving the talk. And the businessman had a wife who was a Buddhist. And she would always drag him to the temple on Waisak Day. Coming up soon, on May the 15th, here in Perth, to be held at Dhammaloka Buddhist Centre. Everybody is welcome. If you are busy that day, never mind. Make yourself unbusy and come anyway. And so he got dragged along, he had to close his shop and go up to the temple. He didn't like it, but you know, to keep his wife from nagging him too much. And when he was there, he didn't know what to do, he was just talking to people, drinking cups of tea. And then the priest, the monk, started giving the sermon, and then he heard the monk talking that if you're going to get reborn into a good realm, the most important condition is your last thought. If your last thought is a good thought, then you go up to a heaven realm. If your last thought is a bad thought, you go to a lower realm. It all depends on your last thought. And the monk continued, some of the best thoughts you can have when you die is to think of the triple gem, the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha. Now that's true. If you can think of the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha just before you die, then you'll go to heaven for sure. And the man thought, wow, you mean I don't have to give all these donations? I don't have to keep precepts? I don't even need to go to the temple? All I need to make sure that I can go to heaven is to think of the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha when I die. That's all. And then he had an insight. A way that he could be absolutely sure that his last thought was the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. As soon as he went home, he got a lawyer. And he changed his son's name, the eldest son to Buddha, the second son to Dhamma, and the third son to Sangha. Because he knew that his children would be by his bedside when he died. You know, even in the West we do that. Your kids are there, you know, holding your hand, just before you cark your last. And anyway, he thought, yes, now I don't need to go to the temple ever again. I don't need to give these donations. It's hard in business. These monks are fat anyway. What do they need with donations? I'm going to keep it myself and enjoy myself. So he just carried on his shop, opened it up every day of the year, even waste that day. He would not go to the temple again. He didn't need to. He's going to go to heaven. And his plan was perfect. Right at the very end of his life, yeah, he was on his deathbed, and there was his three sons, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, next to him, as you would expect. And he was smiling. He'd fixed up his religious part, had a good life. You know, not a good life according to precepts and generosity, a very selfish life, but he'd enjoyed it and indulged himself. And there he was looking at his three sons, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. I'm going to heaven. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, I'm going to heaven. And he's about to die. As he looked, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, I'm going to heaven. And then a thought came into his mind from nowhere. If my three sons are by my bed, who's looking after my shop? And that is when he died. If he's inclining to worrying about his business all his life, that is going to be his last thought. Even if you name your three sons Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, you're not going to think of them at the very end. You're going to be thinking about what you spent your whole life thinking about. For him, his shop. That is why, if you want to have a good death, live a good life. What you're thinking about now, and now, and now, that's what you'll think about when you die. So for some of you, you've got to be very careful. Don't die in the afternoon or evening on a retreat. Otherwise, you'll be thinking of food. And then you certainly will be reborn as a hungry ghost. Okay, there we go. If we are born with certain phobia, and it is very, very difficult to understand the course of meditation, would you recommend hypnosis? Yeah, you can do hypnosis. Actually, there was, okay, a nice old joke, a golden oldie, one of my favorite jokes. Yeah, I mean, hypnosis actually works. So there was this Buddhist monk, I'm not sure to tell you what temple he was in, but, you know, he was just started a new monastery, and it was just so hard to get donations. You know, people just, when you're a new monk, they don't know who you are, you haven't learned how to give talks yet, they don't know whether you're going to stay, so it's very hard to get money to pay the bills. So he was really struggling to keep his temple afloat. And so he went to see this very old monk, very famous, and said, can you help me? And the old monk said, oh yeah, you know, that happened to me when I started off. Because, you know, when I started off, you know, no one knew me and it was very hard to get donations. So what I did was this. When I gave a sermon, I turned up the heater in the hall. So it was really hot and stuffy, closed all the windows. And I deliberately gave a boring sermon in a monotone. So everybody started falling asleep. But just before they fell asleep, I got out my watch, watched the clock, until everybody was hypnotized. And once they were hypnotized, I told them, before you go out, you all must give a donation into the box. But no coins, no fives or tens or twenties, only fifties and hundreds, that's all. You will give $50 and $100 before you go out of this hall. And this young man, I can't do that. That's fraud. That's cheating. No, it's good karma. You're helping people make good karma. Do it. And so he did that. The next time there was a sermon on a Friday night, he turned up the heater in the hall, really hot, closed all the windows. Gave a boring sermon in a monotone until people were so bored they were about to go to sleep. Then he got his watch out. You're all hypnotized. No coins, no fives, no tens or twenties, only fifties and hundreds. And it worked! Because they didn't know they were hypnotized. You know, when you have a talk, how many of you fall asleep? You don't know what I'm doing when you fall asleep. Be careful. And
And so when they left, they all put $50s and $100 into the donation box. The guy cleaned up. He had enough there to pay for the bills for a few weeks. And then when he ran out of money again, because you can't do it every week, because people actually, they'll suss it out, they'll understand what you're up to, and you'll be done, you'll be busted. So he waited for a few weeks, when he needed some more money again, did the same thing again, turned up the heater, closed all the windows, boring sermon, when people are about to fall asleep, he got his watch out. No fives, and oh! He dropped his watch, and he said, shit. And that's what they did. And it took a week to clean that up. You know, the first time I tried to tell that joke was at a Katina ceremony, if you remember that. And I was, because, you know, we needed money for the Katina, I think we're building Jhana Grove or whatever. So we needed the money, and I tried to tell that joke. And Ajahn Yanadhamma, he pulled the plug off my microphone, because he knew the ending. He'd laughed at me. He said, you can't use that word in public. The prude. I did, though. Anyway. So, that's a hypnosis joke. So, anyway, if you wonder why, where we got the money to pay for this place, now you know. So what is it? Certain phobias, yeah, hypnosis works, use it. You seem to differentiate, especially the phobia about putting donations in the box. You seem to differentiate thinking from contemplation, with thinking not desired but contemplation, trying to do it. Insights can lead to more insights. How are they different? Okay, now I've already mentioned. What's this? You know, piece of wood, bong hitter, or whatever. That's thinking. When the words disappear, that's contemplation. Saying what a beautiful sunset is thinking. Seeing the sunset without words, that's contemplation. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for the simile, sitting under the mango tree. It really works for me. Wow, someone got a mango today? I only saw watermelon and, what else was there today? Watermelon and grapes, yeah, no mangoes. So you must be much better than me. So, if you do fall under, sit and put your hand out, get a mango, please share it. That does actually really work. What you meant is you didn't shake the tree. You know, you didn't climb up the tree or throw things at it. You left it alone and it came to you. Well done. It does work. Ajahn Chah said that, you know, from the big boss. Can we be mindful and playful at the same time? Yes, you can. Mindful is being aware. The playful is just being energetic, and also it's actually investigating. You know, that's why play is really good for kids. When they play, they learn the best. I was even taught that in educational psychology. They say if you make a game of the lesson, the children learn more effectively and more quickly. If it's play, that's where we learn. And for some reason or another, when you get to a certain age, you think you're not allowed to play anymore. And so you've got to be serious. And that's when, you know, you start getting stupid and angry and not forgiving and guilty and depressed and all that sort of stuff. So I really think, well, maybe once we finish the teacher's cottage up there, then we'll build in Jhana Grove a playground. You know, swings and slides. Because if your meditation's not going well, you can actually go and have a play around in the playground. You know, I think it would be very popular. So there, you can be mindful and playful at the same time. Or do we have to be serious, not take things lightly? We want to develop mindfulness, kindly light. I've seen people do that. They're so serious and they think they're being mindful. They're just control freaks. Is that the sort of meditator you want to be? Is there not a place for happiness in Buddhism? Wasn't the Buddha a happy being? Why do you think that Buddhism was such a popular religion in the very beginning? No one would ever go to see the Buddha unless he was the charismatic of giving happiness and joy to people. Yeah, taking away their suffering, but also with a sense of happiness. That's wonderful when actually to see that. So yeah, there is... the sense of play. So don't take things so seriously. It makes you angry, frustrated and control freak. Dear Ajahn, the January Sutta retreat was great. Will there be another one soon? That's the one which was done by Ajahn Bamali. He did a retreat where he just read out suttas and explained them. So will there be another one soon? The future is uncertain. Who knows what's going to happen next? So if you want to have a January Sutta retreat soon, you have to make lots and lots and lots of good karma. So it's up to you. Is your karma good enough yet? If not, make some more good karma. Next January, the future is uncertain. He never told me that. Next year, yes. So anyway, yeah, looks like there'll be another one coming soon. Thank you for your much-needed guidance and advice on meditation. The problem now is what to do when all these words and phrases keep flitting in and out of the mind. Watch the breath, make peace, let go, be present, be kind and gentle, love kindness, be mindful, watch the breath, etc. Nimittas, jhanas. It's hard not to want to get nimittas and jhanas because they've been discussed and spoken of and they sound like something meditators should aim for. So how do we stop the wanting? You do mantra meditation. I've already taught you the best mantras. You breathe in, you recite to yourself, shut. You breathe out, up. Shut, up. Shut, up. Shut, up. So try that, because number one, it blocks all those words by just one group of words. And it's giving you instructions. Just shut up. You don't need to keep reciting these things to yourself. You're just disturbing yourself. So don't just talk about it or think about it. Just do it. And then you find watching the breath or making peace, let go, be present, is all the same thing. So you only need the one word. Shh. Say to your mind, shh. That's one word. Which every language, every culture understands. Try that. So you can try that. Mantra. A 96-year-old Roman Catholic man is dying. Does a Buddhist daughter use holy water to help her to pass away peacefully with holy intention? She looks unconscious now. What state is she in now? Yeah, you could use holy water if you like to sort of bless her, because it's not the water, it's you. You're the one who makes it holy by your beautiful intention. So if you want to help your mother dying, it doesn't matter if you use Buddhist holy water or Catholic holy water or whatever. It's the thoughts you have towards your mum. Your intention is pure. You really want to help her, show the love, let her go. So that's a beautiful way of doing things. The water is irrespective of what you add to that water with your perceptions and with your attitude. So yeah, you can do that, but it's what you're doing is important, your attitude. I've said to a lot of people who are still having problems getting still in their meditation, I say, look, the most important thing is not what you're doing or not the object in front of your mind. Nor is it you, it's what's between the two of those things. So it's not your mother dying, it's not you, it's what's between the two of you. Whether you're doing that through fear, control, anger, or whether it really is love and letting go. So sometimes you can actually visualize that. You know, you visualize your object, maybe your dead mother and me, and this space in between. What am I putting into that space? Am I putting fear, control, grasping, holding on? Or am I putting these beautiful things like peace and love and letting go and joy between me and the object? And that's exactly what you're doing in meditation. So you've got the thoughts, you know, still people have got lots and lots of thoughts, you've got you. So make that visualization of the thoughts of maybe a foot or foot in front of you, and you're watching them. What's been in that space between you, the observer, and the observed? And in that space, you will find if you put like interest, involvement, control, then those thoughts are going to keep on going on and on. They won't stop. But if you put this, you know, non-involvement, just letting go, kindness, but really disinterest in those thoughts, then you find the thoughts will stop. So the problem with many people, they don't know where to put their mindfulness. So they're thinking, they're mindful of their thoughts, or they're mindful of themselves watching the thoughts. They're not mindful of the space in between, where the action is. So see if you can focus on mindfulness in the space between you and the object. And in that space, put peace, kindness and gentleness, or any positive word you can think of. And then you'll find the meditation just takes off. It's what's happening in between you and the object. All of life is the relationship issue. It's not what you experience in life, how you experience it. Sickness, death, loss, or just success. That's not important. It's how you deal with success, how you deal with loss. That's where the action of life is. You can't change life. You can't really change yourself. What you can change is how you relate to life. That's where you have the power. What are the general duties of a monk or nun living in a monastery? You know why they're called nuns? Because there's none of this, none of that. That's their general duties, to disappear. Do they have specific daily tasks to perform? Yes, to be holy. And are they assessed on their understanding, skill of learning the Dharma? Thank you. No. They're not assessed, they're loved, even if they're stupid scallywags. Or if they're enlightened arahats with all the psychic powers, they're loved equally. At least that's the goal anyway. To love everybody equally. That's why whatever living beings they may be, whether the weak or strong, omitting none. That's what we just chanted. So in a monastery, whatever monks there are, the wise and the stupid, the fat and the thin, those with great wisdom and no wisdom, may all monks and nuns in the monastery be happy and well. Is that what you chant at Dhammasara? Hope you do, any one day. So no, we don't. It's our general duties. Again, we do have duties, and we do them every day, just sweeping, building, whatever happens to be on the roster. But the general duty, that's actually, we have this monastic rules. This is over and above the Vinaya, which is the rules which every monk, every nun has to keep. In Bodhinyana Monastery, we have these extra rules. We call them core what. And the number one, if you have a look at that book, which somebody wrote down, I said the first rule is be kind. And that's be compassionate. That's the first rule in Bodhinyana Monastery. And all the other ones, how you dress and how you wash your robe and what you should do in the dining room. So those are all subservient to be compassionate and kind. Thanks for being a wonderful teacher. I want to know what is happening to mind when people suffer from dementia, amnesia, etc. What is happening to your mind when you have dementia or amnesia? Is that your mind has been used to just using your brain. So it's been leaning on the brain for such a long time that actually when you have dementia, you just do go into that cloudy state. You don't remember very well. But what happens at the time of death, your mind separates from the brain. It doesn't use the brain because the brain dies. It's like the mind becomes free. And that's when you can remember and you can think and you're back to your old normal self again. So my mother has got dementia. She's got advanced Alzheimer's disease. She can't remember me at all. Or she doesn't know who my brother is either. So she's in this cloud state until, you know, that brain totally gives up eventually. And when that brain dies, then she'll get all of her understanding and knowledge back. I've known many cases. There was a couple of members of our Buddhist society here in Perth, and they told me, actually one of them came regularly, but her sister and her were with their father as her father was on the deathbed. They were on either side of the bed, holding their dad's hand, just waiting for that moment when the last breath would go out and no more air would go in. And when that moment happened, the father opened his eyes and leant up. And she was back on his back. He'd been in a coma for, I don't know, days. Opened his eyes, leaned up, looked at his two daughters on either side, and they said spontaneously, "We love you, Dad." They hadn't planned that. It just came out of their mouth in synchronicity. And then he smiled and fell back and died. And that was the end of him. The last moment was clear. He could see, he could hear. And then he died. That's not uncommon. The brain was stuffed, finished, but he was awake at the very end. That's what happens in dementia. That's what happens with everybody. I mentioned that in a talk I gave at Nolamara, because it's important for you. Because many people, when you're dying, you wonder, should I take the morphine? Because you know if you take the morphine, you'll be in a cloud of unknowing for a long period of time. And they think, my goodness, if I take that morphine, I'll be unmindful when I die. And many people, they're afraid of taking the morphine, but the pain is unbearable. And the answer is, please take the morphine. Yes, you will go into a cloud. You will lose all your mindfulness. But at the very end, when it matters, you will regain your mindfulness. You become clear. Because the morphine is only dulling out your brain. It doesn't dull out the mind. At the end, the mind will be very clear. And that's when you'll be able to do your recollections or whatever else it is you've trained as a Buddhist to do before you die. That's actually what happens. Human beings have not been around for very long, so how do we make sense of all the Buddhas before this present one? Thank you. What do you mean, haven't been around? They've been around for a long time. Many, many eons. This is not the first planet Earth. Even universes get reincarnated. And the previous eon, the Milky Way, was probably the... what's another word for Milky Way? Maybe the soybean way. So, even in science, this is not the first universe cycle. There have been many other Big Bangs. Incredible number of Big Bangs. And so there have been many other universes. There have obviously opportunities for many other sort of planets, human beings, and other Buddhas. So, does Buddhists believe in E.T.? Of course we believe in E.T. It comes out every couple of months. It's our newsletter. But the extraterrestrials and UFOs, of course we believe it. Well, I don't know about UFOs, but there is one sutra in the Anguttara Nikaya which says, yes, there are beings in other worlds, other planets and solar systems. And actually, the Buddha actually says that. It's really weird. I was looking through that and thought, my goodness, the Buddha believes in E.T., in aliens. So there they are. But no, they won't come and visit us. That's the great quote from Calvin and Hobbes, the comic strip, who once said, the surest sign that there is intelligence in outer space is that they won't come and visit us. What intelligent being would want to visit us? They'd be out of their mind come to Earth. Anyway, I better carry on because I don't want to go on too late. I got criticized last night for going too late. Ajahn Brahm, is it correct that even for the most unconscious person, consciousness arrives at the moment of death? Yeah, I just mentioned that consciousness is restored at the moment of death. Regarding the simile of the bottle that has been put down, which shakes even more until it is still, this seems to happen when the breath manifests, and at times there is some sort of letting go experience. Things seem to go a little crazy. There has been a lot of times when I've lost the breath, causing a nervousness to exist when the breath does come. Yeah, because what happens is when the breath arrives, first of all, there's an unconscious, if you're mindful, you can actually see it, manipulating the breath. It's whatever comes into the mind's eye, you mess around with. I've seen many, many women, they go and watch you cooking, and they say, that's not the way to do it, this is the way to do it. We always interfere with each other's cooking. We always interfere with whatever we do and see. Sometimes somebody's sweeping a path and you say, that's not the way to do it. Maybe you've already told Dania, she's the caretaker. That's not the way to do the caretaking. And why is it we always get involved, even though it's none of our business? It's because this is the sense of self in us which always wants to do things better, make things better. It's a good attitude, but it's a stupid attitude. So that's what happens when you watch the breath. As soon as you're aware of the breath, you want to make it better, you want to make it different, you want to interfere with it. And that interfering causes it to get worse. So it's always the case, when the breath comes in, you always disturb it as soon as you watch it. So you have to be patient just to let that disturbance vanish, and so you're not manipulating it anymore. That's actually the sign you've let something go, that it relaxes. Even your body, why is some people's body tense? They just don't know how to let it go, they're always interfering with it. Leave it alone, it's not my body. Do whatever you want, body, bye-bye. So this is actually the noticing, that whatever you notice, first of all, you interfere with. But if you can just let go, it all settles down. The sign you've let go, it's peaceful and disappears. So yes, you've got insight, you've seen what's happening. Now you know what to do, is just be patient and the breath will settle down all by itself. It said that Buddhism would eventually vanish after 2,500 years of the Buddha's parinibbana. As evidence from past history, Buddhists did not go to war or do favors to convert others. Buddhism prevailed in Afghanistan, Iran, Indonesia, Malaysia, and even Egypt, and said in last night's talk, what is your view, Ajahn? Actually, what's said in the suttas was that the Sat Dhamma, the good Dhamma, the pure Dhamma, would only last 500 years. And that's attributed to the Buddha prediction. The true teachings will only last 500 years. Number one, the Buddha was not very used to making predictions. That's the only time there was a prediction with such certainty made in the whole of the suttas. So it is number one, it is out of character for the Buddha to make such a prediction. And number two, you know why he made that prediction? He said, because ordaining bhikkhunis. He said, if we hadn't ordained bhikkhunis, the teaching would have lasted much longer. But now you've ordained bhikkhunis, the teaching will only last for 500 years. Does that sound like a Buddha? Doesn't sound like a Buddha to me. And the icing on the cake is we're 2,500 years and people are still getting enlightened. So the good Dhamma is still here. So you've got a choice here. Either the Buddha was a sexist and got it wrong, because he did get it wrong, it's lasted much longer, or the Buddha never said that. Make your choice. I've made my choice. What do you think the Buddha said? No, it just says 500 years. Many people have tried to spin the teachings. You know, you can actually look it up. That's why it's great to know Pali. It just says, Panchasatavasani, 500 years it will last, that's all. And now you can't say that sort of it was just taken off 500 years from what it's going to be. It's a nice try, but it doesn't wash. It doesn't fit the quote. And anyway, the Buddha never made such predictions. The prediction which he did make, which was much more in line with the Buddha, he said, whenever there's people practicing the Eightfold Path, then there'll be three winners, once returners, non-returners and arahats. He says, as long as you're practicing the way to becoming enlightened, there'll always be people becoming enlightened. Now that's, you know, more the Buddha speaking. He just cause and effect. He didn't say women, gays, sort of Afro-Americans, can Afro-American, transsexual, gay women, can, no, that's not right, is it? But I think you get what I mean. Can they practice the Eightfold Path? Can they? Well, then they can become enlightened. Said the Buddha. So when you say, you know, can women become enlightened? Or can sort of gays become enlightened? Or whatever. If you can practice the Eightfold Path, then you can become enlightened. End of story. And so, if you can practice the Eightfold Path now, the Sad Dharma, the Good Dharma is still here. Now that, to me, that's Buddha speaking. Not the thing will last for 500 years. So, that's why I really doubt that passage. And many other people have said the same. It doesn't fit. It's all the stuff which was added later. Many people have thanked our teacher, but I wish to thank the students for being so respectful and keeping noble silence. Is this being sarcastic? No, you have been. You've done pretty well. Not perfect, but no one is perfect. Always two bad bricks in the wall. There's always some dust in the sky at night. There's always some tiny little thing on the plate. You know, that's where you've got to wipe it off. So many people have thanked our teacher, but I wish to thank the students for being so respectful and keeping noble silence. On my previous 2 9-day retreats at Jhana Grove, many people, maybe most, frequently spoke with or whispered or gestured to friends. I expect my deep gratitude for the silence of this retreat, so conducive to peaceful meditation. Thank you all. Well done. You're quieter than usual. But please, you can always make it quieter. At the time of death, people experience a bright light at the end of the tunnel. And two, our out-of-body experiences. How is this phenomena explained in the Buddhist scriptures? It's obvious, the light at the end of the tunnel, that's the nimitta, the same thing you see in deep meditation. Why is that? Because the nimitta, the really good ones, arise when the five senses stop. When you can't feel the body. When the body disappears. Just like at death. The body disappears, the five senses turn off. It's exactly the same phenomena. Only in meditation, you're still alive. In death, you're gone. So that's only the difference there.